So, welcome everybody. I hope you can hear me properly this time. This is the third lecture in my course on Tranquility and Insight in Early Buddhist Discourse. And I wanted to start again with an apology. Last time we had a technical problem and so you were not able to come into the virtual classroom. But I see that this time it seems to be working. I start with some of the very interesting discussion that happened on the forum during the last week. And I start with discussing an issue of methodology that was raised by Marta Lee Turner. She says, I'm just extracting part of what she says. She says, for example, in Madhyama Agama 72 and Majjhima Nikaya 128, the Chinese version has a story that is lacking in the Pali. And if we reject an imagined scenario in which the editorial board of some school sits down and decides to insert or delete something, possibly for sectarian purpose of defense or defamation, what then? The scholarly world I came from used redact and edit in several ways, both to refer to deliberate, perhaps artistic or doctrinally tendentious changes to a written text, but also to refer to changes to material during oral transmission. Yeah, this is a comment that I'm very happy about. This is something I would really like to discuss and explain a little bit where I'm coming from. The kind of the basis for what I'm also here presenting to all of you is my habilitation work, in which I compared the 152 discourses of the Majjhima Nikaya with their parallels in Chinese, Sanskrit, and Tibetan. And during the course of that work, at a certain point, I really felt that the approach that I was taking based on the traditional way of looking at comparative studies didn't work. And that somehow I was really unable to make sense out of the different variations that one finds between parallel versions of the same discourse. And this became so bad that I actually had to completely go out of the field of Buddhist studies and approach somebody who was working in the area of psychology in order to get information on the working mechanism of the human mind, specifically memory. And going into a completely different and at first sight almost unrelated field and getting into studies of the working mechanics of human memory, I finally found what explained, what could give me a background for contextualizing the variations that I was finding in my research. And that a little bit blew my mind to some extent. And it is from there that I came to appreciate more and more the fact that I myself had not been so aware of at the beginning that these are orally transmitted texts, and that in order to understand their coming into being, it is really crucially important for us to step back out of the world of textual production with which we are familiar in modern days, and to try to really think, see, perceive this material in terms of oral transmission. And from there onwards, my interest is very much in trying to understand this particular type of orally transmitted literature, which is different from the free improvisation that we get in oral transmission of a more narrative type. It's an oral transmission that tries to pass on texts as correctly as possible. This is why I also suggest to my academic colleagues that terms like reductress and editors are not so useful. Because if we speak of a reductor or an editor, we are foregrounding the quality of intentional change. And the term used in the text themselves is bhanaka, bhanaka. And a bhanaka is a reciter. So by using a term like reciter, and this is my recommendation, we are not foregrounding the intentional change activity. Obviously, reciters also can sometimes change intentionally. We are not excluding that, but we are actually foregrounding the activity that those responsible for transmitting the text were mainly supposed to be engaged in, and I take it that most of them actually tried also to recite those texts, to recite them in the sense of learning them from someone else, keep on reciting them by oneself to keep them alive in memory, at times reciting them in a teaching or preaching context, at other times reciting them in a communal recitation with others to rehearse, and at times reciting them to their own students to pass on these texts. That was their main activity. And if we start to think in terms of reciters, we are a little bit closer, as far as we can from our modern day world, to this ancient world in which these texts came into being. And I think this is really crucial, and I'm really happy that Marta brought that up, because I'm sometimes wondering, like, am I not making myself clear? Because there are some of my academic colleagues and my friends, I have kind of given all this explanation and I'm writing it, and they still keep on talking to me about reductors and editors, and also approaching any kind of difference from this perspective that now I must find out why did they do it? What motivated the reductors and editors to change, to revise this, to write it in a different way? And I'm always a little taken aback, and I'm not saying that there may not be sometimes an intention behind a change. I'm not wanting to exclude that, obviously. But this is not the very first thing that comes to my mind when I find changes between parallel versions, when I find differences. The first thing that comes to my mind is, oh, this is oral transmission. I last time I was giving this example of this children game, Stille Post, we call it in German there. Where one whispers the story to the next and to the next and to the next, and in the end the story that comes out is quite different from what we had at the beginning, even though everyone had the task to pass it on correctly. So if we come to this story, here's the picture from Nagarjunikonda of that story. So if we look at this story, my argument is that even such a major difference, we have this long, long story in the Madhyama Agam version, which is not found in the Pali version, could be an accident of oral transmission. It need not absolutely necessarily be that somebody said and say, let me put in this story, that would be very nice. It could be, obviously, but I'm saying this is not the only possible explanation. And the thing is, this story as such, this about this king being killed and then the son having a chance to have his revenge and then forgiving, the story is known in various of the Buddhist schools, and it is associated with this Kosambi incident. This story, some of you were discussing that on the forum, this story about a very small issue of proper conduct according to the Vinaya, then leading to a large dispute, completely gone out of hands. And so even a short reference to this Kosambi incident brings to mind that story in the mind of a reciter. And so it's not totally out of the question that perhaps one or the other reciter, while reciting the discourse, is just giving more explanation as an aside. Not like I'm reciting the sutta, say, Evang Me Sutang, etc. And at that time, the Buddha was talking to the monks of Kosambi, and he was giving them this and this kind of instruction. And actually, you know, this Kosambi story, as we know from somewhere else, there is also this whole beautiful story the Buddha gave, and I give you the whole story, and I come back to the sutta. So the time, suppose I'm a reciter and you are listening, the time I'm doing this, I'm very clear, you are also very clear, Anarya was just giving us the sutta, and then he stepped out of the sutta, and he gave us this commentary, as a personal comment by Anarya, he gave us this story, and then he went back into the sutta. But now you, as reciters, also find this story very beautiful, because it really, as I think Robert Grosch said on the forum, it really gives us a message. And so you, when you recite the discourse, you may also recite the story, and maybe you still clearly know it was a commentary, and the next to whom you teach it also knows, but some way down the line of those who recite the discourse, the distinction between sutta and commentary becomes blurred. And at some point, what originally was just an explanation, a commentary, becomes actual discourse, actual sutta. And I've written a paper on this where I'm showing a number of cases, specifically in the Chinese Agamas, we can easily show that because we have in the commentary tradition in Pali. And so we can see, like we put two suttas side by side, and we find, in this sutta, this part, the Pali commentary gives that explanation. And in the Chinese, we find the explanation as part of the discourse. I think the same also works in the other direction, but I have not been able to show so many cases of that because we do not have the commentarial tradition in Chinese. We have very few commentaries preserved in Chinese. But I'm right at present working on showing that this is the case for the Brahmajala Sutta, the first discourse in the Digha Nikaya, the sections on the silas. There are three different sections on silas. And in the Tibetan version, we have only the first. And I think with close examination, I'm able to prove that the second section on sila in the Pali version originally was a commentary on the first. It's very fascinating. And this whole thinking in terms of oral transmission, again, I made a discovery very recently where I think I'm able to settle something that has been discussed for many years among scholars, and this I cannot present to you now because the research is not completed yet. Simply because I'm looking at it from the perspective of oral transmission. And so I think this looking at oral transmission is very, very important. And another example I want to give about this relationship between the original text in quotation marks and the commentary. We have this, there's a collection of verses in the Sutta Nipata called Attakavaga. And in the Pali, in the Theravada tradition, the Attakavaga, we have just the verses, just the stanzas. But we have a Chinese translation of the Attakavaga, and this has the stanzas together with prose. And the stories given in the prose to explain what happened, to explain the historical background of the stanzas, are similar to those found in the Pali commentary tradition. So this is very similar to our case of this story of the King Long Life. And we have the opposite in the case of the Udana. In the case of the Pali Udana collection, we have the stanzas together with prose. But the other Udana collections that we have in Sanskrit, in Tibetan, and also in Chinese, for the most part, have no prose. They just have plain verses. So it seems that we have here the same phenomena of poetry, stanzas, or verses being in some way related to a story that explains how this came into being. But the decision, or maybe not even a decision, the fact of whether this background story becomes part of the canonical collection is different in different traditions. So the actual difference is not such a huge difference. Stanzas are connected to stories. This Kosambi incident is connected to the story of King Long Life. But according to how the text was passed down in one particular translation lineage, in that way, sometimes the story becomes part of the actual discourse. This is a comment by Damodina. She says, yes, to a certain reductional intention is indeed the crucial principle for Western text critical studies and philology. The altogether different notion of textual intention that operates in the Indian Buddhist context cannot be accounted for if one remains within a framework that in a way doesn't apply. We cannot trace back reductional authorial intention in the same way. I'm beginning to lose you with all these slash things. Other determinant conditions are in operation. Chief intention is to preserve Buddha's words as accurately as possible, as you say. Your research shows that this intention is reflected by the way change happens in this type of literature. This intention is our philological guideline, I think. Yeah, I'm losing you a little bit there, but I think we are hopefully speaking about the same thing. And I'm coming back to this topic because Marta also made a very beautiful comment on the issue of the poetry. But that was just my basic thing, and I really appreciate also any input from you now or on the in the forum if what I'm saying is not clear, because I mean it's possible that my position is wrong. Yeah, we don't know. Anario. It is possible that I am not expressing myself clearly enough, or it is possible that simply because what I'm saying is somewhat against the grain of the traditional approach, it just takes a little while. But it seems to me that it really seems crucial to think in terms of oral transmission, to make a real effort to step out of our world of redactors and editors who sit down in a kind of round the table kind of thing and intentionally now discuss. Well, I'm exaggerating a little bit, obviously, but now, what shall we do with this Madhyama Agama 72? Shall we not put a little story in there to flesh it up and then raise your hands if you're against it? I mean, you see what I'm saying. I'm obviously not wanting to exclude that there may sometimes it could well be that one reciter just purposely decide, okay, this story is so beautiful it has to be part of the discourse, obviously. And this is a very gross difference, but as we continue discussing the sutta, we will come to more differences which are of a smaller type. And if you take the time either to study my habilitation or to simply read parallel versions of discourses side by side, we find so many small changes which, it would be really difficult to find a reason this is why somebody would have made this different. And I think it leads us away from the text instead of letting us closer to the text. Because as Venerable Damodina said, it is thinking in a framework that doesn't really apply. It is operating based on modes of textual production familiar to us and not really fully engaging with the fact that these texts have been produced in a very different way. That is, in a modern day world with books and internet and email, really difficult for us to imagine, but really worthwhile. It becomes really fascinating when one gives more thought to it and tries to go into that. So that was my comment on methodology. Then there was Bernard Font on my brief discussion of Stephen Batchelor's. Yeah, so he says, you commented on Stephen Batchelor's interpretation of craving arising from dukkha, which I also find very interesting and at a practical level makes sense to me and is compatible with the classical one. Yeah, and this I like to take this up now because it, to some degree, it has still a relation to methodology. I fully resonate with Bernard that it is it makes practical sense, but the point I'm making is that it is not compatible with the classical interpretation. And there is one comment just made before we started our lecture by Bhikkhu Dhammadasa, which I want to start off with. He says, in brief, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. He says, thus it would seem very clear that all that he said before is summarized at the five clinging aggregates and not simply the five aggregates. Otherwise, he would have said, in brief, the five aggregates and the five clinging aggregates are suffering. I think that's a very good point, because that is one of the problems I see with Stephen's interpretation, that the fact that there's consciousness and name and form, etc., in the 12 links doesn't necessarily mean that these are clinging aggregates. And my example is in the case of the Arahant. Ignorance is gone. These aggregates are still there, and they are unsatisfactory in the sense. They are dukkha in the sense of being unsatisfactory, but they do not lead to the actual experience of dukkha. And the reason why I took up Stephen's interpretation is I'm just writing on this. I'm doing a two-paper study of the Chinese parallels to the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and the first has already been published. And in the second, I need to take this up because Stephen himself says that this is the interpretation he thinks that stands behind what, according to tradition, was the first discourse spoken by the Buddha. So he is not only presenting this as a personal skillful means at the practical level, but actually he is assuming that this is implicit in the canonical version of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And in his paper, and here I'm just giving you the reference to the paper, so if anybody wants to look it up, this is a paper on secular Buddhism. On page 90, he says that his creation of secular Buddhism, the precondition is that it would need to be founded upon canonical source texts. So from a methodological perspective, what I'm saying is that, yes, this may be very useful practically speaking, but the premise that this is representing the canonical source text is not correct. And this is all I'm saying here. And this is also to bring us a little bit back to our general topic, what we are doing all together here in this course, even when we discuss tranquility and insight. We are not really there to make value judgments on stuff that may be practically relevant or not, but we are trying to sort out what is there in the canonical sources through the methodology of historical critical comparative study. And based on that, then anybody is totally free to approach things in whatever way she or he prefers. It's not, we are not using this to say this is wrong, this is right, this teacher didn't get it, this teacher got it, but just we are trying to build up a scientific foundation in our understanding of early Buddhism. And it is based on that scientific foundation of our understanding that then we may pursue it academically, we may pursue it personally as a Buddhist who is practicing it, and in whatever way this seems right or for us, that is fine. So the next topic is on terminology. This is from Michael Beisert. So what he says, we have been discussing this samatha, what was it, samatha passaddhi and samadhi, and I had basically said that there is it's a little difficult to fix them down neatly because there is some degree of overlap between these qualities, the tranquility in general, which is one of the two topics in our course, samatha, the word samadhi, concentration, and then passaddhi, tranquility as an awakening factor. So Michael Bizet says, although I can understand what you said, that to some extent there is an overlap in the qualities of Samadhi, Samatha and Passabdhi, I'm getting the impression that the suttas describe two separate strands for developing wisdom and liberation. One pair is the combination Samatha Vipassana, and the other is Samadhi and Yathabhuta Jnanadasana, Nibbida Viraga Vimutti. In many suttas, Nivarana, these other hindrances, are described as obstructions, corruptions of the mind, and weakening wisdom. The suttas also mention that the suppression of the Nivarana takes place with Samadhi and the Jhanas. As far as I know, there is no sutta which says that the Nivarana are suppressed with Samatha. Therefore, one can argue that the insight which arises either prior, after, or in conjunction with Samatha will be weak. Could be a corruption of the mind and also an obstruction. Why? Because there is no guarantee that the Nivarana would be suppressed with Samatha. Yeah, I found this very interesting, but I still would like to give a few more points. Again, I'm relying here on Bhikkhu Dhammadasa. He already made a comment in the forum to the last lecture. He notes that when we look closely at the Buddha's sutta description of the four form jhanas, we can find both the term samadhi in the second. And samadhi is not mentioned in the first, third or fourth form jhanas. I think this is already one good point. The fact that the word samadhi is only mentioned in the second absorption doesn't mean that in the first, third and fourth absorption samadhi is not there. It just means that for understanding the second absorption, the fact that the happiness experienced in the second absorption is born of concentration is a significant characteristic. And we will be discussing the jhanas later on when we come to the discourse. And another comment made by Manfred Wiesberger. Whoops. There he goes. He says, though it might make things more complicated after explaining the relation between tranquility and insight, it might be useful to know how that relates to the four kinds of samadhi bhavanas mentioned in Anguttara Nikaya 441. Yeah, that is a very good example to support my point. In this Anguttara Nikaya discourse, we are presented with four types of samadhi bhavana, cultivation of samadhi. And number three is to see vedana, sanya and vitaka, that is sensation or feeling, perception and thought as they arise and pass away. And number four of this cultivation of samadhi is to contemplate the five aggregates as arising and passing away. So I think this discourse makes it very clear that it is not possible to, even the word samadhi, you can't confine it to tranquility, to concentrating in the way we usually use it, but it also covers insights. So the terms are used with such a range of meaning that it is very difficult in the early discourses to really cut them down to one thing. This means this only and nothing else. And there's a few more passages that I just like to run by you. Let me see. Oh, so this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, and it says that for the awakening factor of concentration, for its arising, there is a certain nutriment. And this nutriment is samatha nimitta, the sign of samatha, of tranquility. Nimitta is something we are also going to discuss later on today. So here, very clearly, samatha is very closely related to concentration. It is that which brings about concentration. And we get the reverse. In this discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya, here the question is, how do I get ajhattang cheto samatang, internal samatha of the mind? And the instructions are, this person is going to be explained, katang chitang samadha tabbang, how to samadhi the mind, how to concentrate the mind. So you see, I mean, already with these two quotations, we see the samatha in the first is the one that leads to the awakening factor of samadhi, and here we have the samadhi of the mind is what leads to the samatha. And in relation to the hindrances, there's one more quote, also from Anguttara Nikaya. It says, in particular, for overcoming restlessness, which is one of the five nibbaranas, the five hindrances, samatha should be developed. So, what we can take from this perhaps is a look at concepts in early Buddhism from the perspective of their utility value, not, as Robert Grosch said so nicely, I should not cling to specific words. The early discourses use terminology in a somewhat free way. The Shaila Catherine in the forum, she even brought up that beautiful passage on tanhang nisaya tanha pahatabba, in dependence on craving, tanha, craving tanha should be abandoned. This is a use of tanha which is unique, and you will never, I don't think it will be difficult to find that in later tradition where tanha is entirely unwholesome. But in the sutta period, the terminology is not always neatly defined. It has this somewhat open edges, because concepts are seen as not carrying a value in themselves, but also not as being a problem in themselves, but simply as fingers pointing to the moon. You want to look at the moon and not at the finger. I'm coming to another topic. Hope I'm not getting too tiring for all of you, all these different things. And feel free to chuck in questions anytime you want. This is, we are coming to the Yugananda, the four types of relationships between tranquility and insight approach to stream entry we discussed last time. There's Jayanta Gunavardhana. He says he's about the topic of rebirth. While there would of course be no need for any view on rebirth for successful tranquility meditation and samadhi, I was, however, of the belief that such a view was an essential prerequisite for realizing supramundane panya, wisdom, through insight meditation. Does not the development of panya commence with sammaditti at the mundane level, that is a right view, where it includes an acceptance of the law of karma? I would have thought it would be difficult to make sense of this law if vision is restricted to a single birth. Yeah, I am not aware of canonical support for the notion that one needs to accept rebirth in order to be able to gain stream entry. And the right view required for stream entry would be, I take it to be the right view of the Four Noble Truths. So, I think for many, in the West especially, the doctrine of rebirth is difficult to approach, and this is one of the points that Stephen Batchelor is making. And so until one has some kind of meditative experience perhaps that may corroborate this, I feel it is safe to simply leave it as one of the aspects of the Buddhist teachings where one need not necessarily take a position. I don't think one has to chuck it out and say this is impossible, because there's not really any ground for taking that. But also one doesn't have to accept it unless one feels it acceptable. And I don't think such an attitude would make it difficult for the person in question to proceed to stream entry. Then there was a comment by Jeff Hardin, and I'm just giving you the suttas that he is referring to. And here comes his question. Do you see all these as an example of number three, that is the third approach in the Yugananda, the conjunction, the Yugananda? Or is it possible that one has to emerge from jhana to practice inside rather than investigating Dhamma while still in jhana? Yeah, Jeff is good at throwing at me these difficult questions where I get into controversial waters. So the issue of developing insight while one is inside an absorption is a contested topic. So all I can do here is present my take on it without wanting to claim that I got it right and everybody else got it wrong. As far as I can see, it is not really possible to develop insight while one is inside an absorption, really fully immersed in an absorption. And the three passages that Jeff has brought up, Majjhima Nikaya 111 is the Anupada Sutta. And I'm just now working on this and writing on it. The discourse does not have any parallel. And the descriptions given there, Professor Schmidthausen has already shown that they are there is an addition that has happened. And this very detailed analysis given of each jhana according to this discourse done by Venerable Sariputta seems to be a later development, which can very clearly be seen from the fact that some terms are mentioned even twice. So the Anupada Sutta Majjhima Nikaya 111 is probably a very good testimony for a development in Buddhist thought, but it is probably not such a good evidence for actual meditation practice. In fact, I'm using this discourse as part of an overall argument I'm making in a monograph I'm working on right now, where I try to show the beginnings of Abhidharma, the very approach or attitude that is characteristic of Abhidharma, contrary to what is found in early Buddhism. And if we take the other two discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya 52 and 64, and if we read them, I think both interpretations are possible from the discourses itself. The interpretation that these mean that while one is inside the jhana, one is doing insight, or the interpretation that I personally prefer, that one emerges from absorption. And coming out a little bit from that, but still being deeply concentrated, one develops insight at that time. In the last course, last year, we discussed this already. I gave this example of being in water. I jump into the water, I'm completely immersed in the water, and now I come up and my head is above the water surface, which means that I can do things which I cannot do when I'm completely inside the water. I can speak, I can also hear if you are saying something. And my condition is a little difficult to describe in black and white terms. If I say Analu is in the water, it's not completely correct because my head pokes out. But if I'm saying Analu is out the water, it's also not correct because from the neck down to the feet, I'm inside the water. So there is this area when somebody is not fully immersed in an absorption and comes out a little bit, and then things can happen or can be done that are not really compatible with full absorption attainment. But my own understanding is that a full absorption attainment is a condition where the mind is unified. In a unified mind, it is not really possible to see arising and passing away. It is not really possible to see conditionality. So unless the object of the unification is nirvana, it is not really possible to develop insight in the way this can be done when one is outside of a jhana. And I also see the combination between jhana and insight to be really the point that when somebody goes into an absorption, I think we discussed that briefly last time, when somebody goes into an absorption, at that time it is really time to fully go into it and to fully be and experience that. But then there comes naturally a time when one comes out of the deep concentration. And at that time it is really meaningful to look back on what happened in order to understand how it happened, so next time one can get into it again, but also to have this clear understanding that this, however sublime, however profound this experience was, this too is impermanent. This too is conditioned. This too is something that I should not cling to. It's something I can enjoy while it lasts, but there it's gone again. And that impermanence, conditionality, dukkha, not lasting satisfaction, not self, not identifying with it. These kind of contemplations done at that time have a very profound impact on the mind, because the mind is still very receptive and calm, and also because the experience of deep concentration is just so much more powerful than anything one can experience in the outer world of the senses. So that understanding that this too is impermanent and something to become disenchanted with, it takes care of all the lesser types of happiness in the outer world. Then there was a comment by Ciprian Salagian. I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly. And he commented on number 4 in the Yogananda Sutta. And he said that there are stories in the suttas of people who become stream winners or even arahants on their deathbed. Could it be possible that in that state, just before dying, the mind becomes steady and unified? Yeah, so from the perspective of early discourses, it seems that the moment of death is seen as something that has a high potential for progress, if one is able to meet the moment of death with detachment and letting go. This is obviously quite challenging, difficult for us in everyday life. The moment of death is much more difficult. This is why it's important to train in those qualities. And this is the perspective early Buddhism gives, as far as I can see, that the emphasis is on the cultivation of those qualities that will enable us to meet death in the proper way, in the best possible way. And it is only with later tradition that there comes more interest in what happens right after death, where the mind goes, whatever might happen. But the pragmatic attitude of early Buddhism is more or less, if I can say it very simply, what's happened after death, you're going to see yourself anyway, but get ready for the time when it happens. Get ready for the time by cultivating those qualities of detachment and letting go that enable you to die well. And another point made by Ciprian, he describes his way of practicing mindfulness of breathing as cultivating both tranquility and insight. And I would just wanted to say that, yeah, that is the potential of this particular meditation practice, mindfulness of breathing, that it can be used for both. It can be used as a way of cultivating tranquility and as a way of cultivating insight. And it's a very powerful statement by Shala Catherine on the fourth mode of the Yogananda Sutta. She says, "I find the fourth mode of approaching awakening quite intriguing, as it may point to the powerful effect of urgently wanting liberation. The desire for liberation can be so strong that the force of this desire, rather than sustained tranquility, effectively dispels all distractions and hindrances. When we want one thing, Nibbana, we don't want other things. And when nothing else interests the mind, a profound dispassion towards mental and material phenomena may arise. There will be no conflict, no pull to anything except the deathless liberation." Yeah, beautiful. I think that helps me to get a stronger taste of the fourth quality. Makes a lot of sense to me. And a final comment on these four different approaches by Lothar Birke. Yeah, I love that one. He has this, I had him in my courses at Hamburg University on Satipatthana. He has this way of really pinpointing things. He says, in the end, first, both qualities will be necessary in the end. Second, both qualities are very helpful at any point along the way. Third, there's more than one way to do it. And yeah, that's the point. Yeah, I very much resonates with me. It's really tranquility and insight are both required. Both are helpful at any time, and there's no fixed way. There is no, the canonical discourses do not give us a prescription. Say only this way you got to do it. There's more than one way to do it. So after this preliminary survey, we come now to the discussion of the Upakilesa. We are still with the comments in the forum. This is Jeff Harding again. He asked about the Dhammapada parallels to the stanzas that are found in Majjhima Nikaya 128 and also in the Madhyama Agama version. And I'm just giving some of the references here. They are found in the Udana, in the Dhammapada, and also in the Sutta Nipata. And then Marta Lee Turner has been commenting on this kind of parallelism, and I found her comments very, very interesting, so I would like to us to go through them. The first thing she says is, you know, we are talking about this fact that in this discourse we have these verses and we also get them somewhere else in the verse collections, Dhammapada, etc. I think one possibility is that if one form of a saying transmitted orally reaches widespread familiarity, a speaker can then evoke its memory by using a similar pattern of words. For example, if the monks at Kosambi knew the material in the Dhammapada, it would make complete sense for the Buddha to intentionally evoke that memory in remonstrating with them about their dispute. This assumes that despite the absence of a written text, certain verbal material has become widely known. In a context of memorization and accurate recitation, that familiarity seems a certainty. In consequence, the Buddha in later talks had the option of referring back to his own earlier talks that were already circulating widely. And then she asked, might some of the unvarying formulas that are repeated many times in the suttas have originally been more gracefully adapted allusions, but in the course of transmission became assimilated to the originals or to an unvarying form so that they now seem quotations? Yeah. That's the way I would also understand it. And she gives a second explanation. Another group of possibilities, somewhere in the recited transmission, someone was struggling to remember the words delivered in Kosambi by the Buddha and combined the Dhammapada pattern of words with the Buddha's point at Kosambi as a good and safe approximation of what he said there. Or similarly, a reciter may have felt that the material he had received was too short or missing something, and felt it both natural and honest to complete his version of the Buddha's address there with the pattern of the Buddha's own words and ideas familiar from earlier occasions. Our ideas of how to handle intellectual property do not extend to antiquity. In fact, I would personally feel comfortable calling scenarios like this reduction, but also happy enough to use another word. Yeah, so I think it's also what I found often is also that, and this is a pattern has been observed already by Professor von Hinüber, that once there is one word, because of the patterns of association, it can carry a whole passage from somewhere else to this place. So if there is one particular, maybe let us say originally the version, I'm just giving one possible scenario. Originally, the version of this discourse had just a single verse, just one verse, but this was somehow on patience. Then the fact that there are other verses on patience, by a simple association, can draw from the store of remembered passages to bring this to this place also. And eventually we get this whole long series of stanzas. So it is possible that somebody, as Marta described, decides consciously, well, there's not enough here, I have to add something. But it's also possible that such material gets drawn in simply by a very common problem of human memory by association. She also explores a third possibility, but I'm not putting that in because she says that this has nothing to do, it's different from the trained ability to take in and reproduce whole conversation, and this is what we're talking about in oral transmission. Then there was a question by Linda Grace. She was just asking if the translation patience for the Chinese is the same as Kanti, and does the story in the Vinaya mention Kanti? So I'm just giving you the particular verse here. Oop, there it is. I hope you can read the Chinese. It's a little small. So the second character is the one that renders Kshanti or Kanti, patience. And the parallel stanzas found in the Majjhima Nikaya and in the Vinaya use the word avera. And while this is not, strictly speaking, patience, it is still sufficiently close in meaning, because when you're patient, you're not get angry, and when you're not get angry, you're being patient. And I think Bernard Font, he made this, he asked whether, I'm giving this full quote, I think. He asks, it is interesting to note that the Pali Sutta speaks in negative terms, non-hatred, while the Chinese version uses a positive term, patience. I would be interested in knowing if this is a difference one finds repeatedly when comparing the Chinese agamas and the Pali Suttas, the difference in style or emphasis, and if this might be due to the Pali tradition being more rooted in the ascetic renunciation tradition. Yeah, I thought that's an interesting question, but so far I have not seen this really as a pattern. I think it's more a question of language. In the Indic languages, we have this strong tendency of like my name is made of Alayo, and then there comes an R. I'm not Alayo is my name. And because two R's don't work together, then there's an. There's an N in between. We have this strong tendency of saying anything is good, and then are good, not good, bad. Of using this negative terms in this way, but actually they don't carry a negative sense. They carry a very positive sense. So my name actually, I would translate it as detachment. Well, not that I am detached, but I should try to be, obviously. And I would not translate it as non-attachment. It's just a question of language. But in the Pali or Sanskrit or Indic languages, Analayo gives me that same sense that I would in English convey with detachment. And the last comment from Bernard. It seems to me, speaking from a practitioner point of view, then patience here acts like the observing mind in Vipassana meditation. Namely, not reacting at first impulse, but waiting and watching the phenomenon and seeing the consequences, then identifying the root of the problem. I thought that was a very nice way of bringing into being also the aspect of insight meditation here at that point. So this completes my survey of issues that have arisen in the forum. And yeah, I really wanted to express my appreciation again to all of you for the high quality comments and questions you make. You see, for me, what comes now, from now on until the end of the lecture, is kind of boring because I know what I'm going to say. But the things that you bring up in the forum, the discussion, the seriousness, and the way how you mull things over, this is new for me, and this is where I learn. So I think it's really nice we have this balance kind of thing, that I get my chance to learn from you. And now comes the part which, at least hopefully for you, is not as boring as it is for me, where I'm just talking about things that I already know. Yeah, so we are back with our discourse. We were at the place where the Buddha has delivered this story, and then he draws out the implication. Monks, those monarchs, anointed warrior kings, rulers of great countries, in governing their country, themselves practice patience in the face of insult, and in turn praise such patience. Themselves practice loving kindness, and in turn praise loving kindness. Monks, you too should be like that. Having left home out of faith and gone forth to practice the path, you should practice patience in the face of insult and also praise such patience. You yourself practice loving kindness and also praise loving kindness. Yeah, this kind of gives us the gist of the whole story. And it sets the basis for what in the rest of the discourse is very much on meditative development and a strong emphasis on samatha, but also, as Bernard and also Linda Grace pointed out, there is also a nudge on insight there. So after this clarification by the Buddha, I'm now abbreviating. The monks are still continue their quarrel. They won't even let the Buddha stop them. So the Buddha leaves them. He just walks away. And first he goes to visit the monk Bhagu, who lives all alone by himself. And it's interesting that the Madhyama Agama version gives a stronger emphasis on the meditation practice that this Bhagu is doing while living alone, whereas in the Pali version this is not so prominent. And then the next thing in the Madhyama Agama version is that the Buddha goes to live in the company of an elephant. In the Theravada Vinaya, where we also get the story of the Kosambi accident, we also get the dwelling with the elephant, but this comes after the Buddha has visited Anuruddha and his companions. This is again one of those differences in oral transmission where it's, I personally find this elephant in the Madhyama Agama version a little bit, it feels nicer to have it like first he visits a single monk, then the single elephant, and then he visits the group. But that is just a personal preference. And it would be difficult to build up an argument why somebody should move the meeting with the elephant to first before the Anuruddha or after Anuruddha meeting. Whereas when we see it in line with the general pattern of orally transmitted text, we find that again and again and again the same items are presented in different order, simply because this is the way how the human memory works. It easily mixes up the sequence but still remembers the main points. And here we get another, before I get into the text, you get another difference that in the Madhyama Agama version, the way how Anuruddha and his friends are practicing is described by the narrator, that the reciter, the Bhanaka. But in the Pali version, it is Anuruddha himself, when asked by the Buddha, who describes it. Again, this is a difference where difficult to say which one is right or more early, more correct. It makes no substantial difference to the discourse, really, whether the narrator tells us, look, they lived in this way, or whether Anuruddha himself says it. So here we get a description of their living together. I am going to read it for you now. So whichever of them came back first from begging alms food would set out the seats, draw water, and put out the utensils for washing feet, the foot mat, the cloth for wiping feet, the water pot, and the bathing bowl. If he was able to finish the food he had received, he would finish it. But if there were leftovers, he would put them in a container and cover it. Having completed his meal, he would put away his bowl, wash his hands and feet, and with his sitting mat over his shoulders, go into a hut to sit in meditation. Whichever of them came back last from begging alms food would eat all of the food if he was able to. And if it was not sufficient, he would take from the food previously left over and eat until he had had enough. If there were still leftovers, he would empty them out on the bare ground or into water that contained no living beings. He would take the eating utensils and, having washed them clean and wiped them, would put them away to one side. He would gather and roll up the sitting mats and put away the utensils for washing feet, collecting the foot mat, the cloth for wiping feet, the water pot, and the bathing bowl. After having swept and sprinkled the dining hall so that it was clean and free of refuse, he would put away his robe and bowl, wash his hands and feet, and with his sitting mat over his shoulder, go into a hut to sit in meditation. In the afternoon, if the first of those venerable ones to rise from sitting in meditation saw that the water pot or the bathing bowl was empty of water, he would take it and go to fetch water. If he was able to, he would carry it back and place it to one side. If he was not able to carry it, he would beckon with his hand to another monk, and the two would carry it together and place it to one side, without speaking to each other, without asking each other anything. Once in 5 days, those venerable ones would assemble to discuss Dharma together or to maintain noble silence. Yeah, I've been going in a little detail with you through this description because I think it's really very significant the way it describes how these three monks live together. For when it really shows this harmonious cooperation, all pointing at meditation. They are living together in such a way that it really enables them to do their practice. But at the same time, they do not neglect cleanliness of the place, putting things into order for the sake of meditation. And there's something I would like to quote here. This is from I hope you can see that. Oops. This is from a book by Mohan V. Jayaratna, Buddhist Monastic Life According to the Text of the Theravada Tradition. There's a preface on introduction by Stephen Collins. This is one of our really outstanding Buddhist scholars. And in that preface, he comments on a view that is fairly widely held and that seems to go back to an Indian scholar named Dutt. He says, according to Dutt, the rainy season retreat, that is the 3 months that the monastics stay in one place, when monks stay together in one place, was the turning point from wandering to settled life. But as Dr. Vijayaratna explains, what the text actually contains is more complex. While they do say that moving from place to place was an important part of the early community's lifestyle, they also say that the Buddha accepted a path donated as a residence by King Bimbisara of Magadha very soon after his enlightenment and founding of the order. Thus, when members of the community travel, they usually went from one such park or monastery to another. And another, next page, page 16. To accept the myth of a transition from eremitical to cenobitical life is, as the Christian terminology shows, to impose on Buddhist monastic history categories derived from the received wisdom about the Christian tradition. And next page. The evidence shows that the ideal system of monasticism they present is in general a single and coherent one. We are not presented with a series of historical layers and an evolution from one thing to another. Yeah, I thought this very interesting and helpful comment in the sense that this idea which I had also been adhering to, that like the earliest stage of the Buddhist monastic community was just this kind of free wandering without any fixed abode, and it is almost like a deterioration that communal life came into being, that is not really what the sources convey to us. And while I think seclusion, intensive practice in solitude, is a very important and emphasis aspect of practice in early Buddhism, communal life is there throughout. And this type of communal life can be very meditative, and this is why I went with you in detail through this description of how these three monks live together. It can be very meditative. And there's a little experience I just wanted to share. Just recently I was in the States teaching at several places, and I also was at one place where the meditation course was offered free of any charge. And this is a meditation center that has just recently established itself without being part of any kind of established tradition. And it was very beautiful to see, because all the tasks done during the course were done by the meditators themselves. So cooking, cleaning, everything that needs to be done for the continuity of the course one of the meditators sitting the course had to do this, and there was a kind of a rooster. Everybody was taking his part, and at the beginning and at the end of the course, we would sit in a circle. It was very much a community undertaking. And what I notice is that this approaching the practice from this group kind of perspective made one thing very strong, and that is external mindfulness. Mindfulness towards surroundings. Mindful awareness of, does my behavior disturb others? How can I smoothly interrelate? And this is a very important aspect of meditative cultivation in early Buddhism, and this is what this text is also pointing us to, and which sometimes can get lost out of sight if one is very much only on my meditation, what I want to get, what I'm trying to do here. And basically, I had that when I was recently ordained. Basically, this idea, everybody else just get out of the way. Go aside, because here I come and I want to go. And that is, in my case, it led to a very unbalanced form of practice. Here then is another passage from the discourse, which is again interesting from the viewpoint of oral transmission. The park warden, who had seen the Blessed One coming in the distance, stopped him, saying, "Renunciant, renunciant, do not enter this park." "Why? In this park there are three clansmen, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandi, and the Venerable Kimbila. If they were to see you, they might disapprove." Yeah, we get the same thing that there's somebody who is at the entrance of the park and is preventing the Buddha from entering, not realizing that this is the teacher of Anuruddha and the other two. We get the same also in the Pali version and also in the Chula Gosinga Sutta and its parallels. And the location of Chula Gosinga, Majjhima Nikaya 31, and also the content of the discourse, which is another visit to Anuruddha and his friends, makes it clear that these are two different occasions, because in the present discourse, as we are going to see soon, our three friends have problems with their meditation, but in the Chula Gosinga Sutta, they are fully accomplished meditators. So again, it seems that in one of these two visits, there was this part of the narration that the park warden stopped the Buddha from going into the discourse. And it is easily possible that during that oral transmission of these discourses within the same collection, Majjhima Nikaya, Madhyama Agama, Ekottarika Agama, that because there is the story, Buddha goes to see Anuruddha and his friends, the tale, the Buddha is being stopped by the park warden, comes to be applied to all, to both visits. Whereas from the logic of the story, we would think that happens once, but it won't happen twice. Yeah, so obviously Anuruddha stops the park warden, the Buddha gets in. He doesn't have to stand outside. Yeah, and here we are again on the preparations for good meditative conditions, and now we come from keeping the place in order to the appropriate attitude towards each other. And we keep in mind that the Buddha is just coming from having witnessed how quarrelsome the monks at Kosambi are. So at that time, the Buddha, having washed his hands and feet, sat down on the seat set out by that Venerable One. Having sat down, he asked, "Anuruddha, your consulate ease, lacking nothing." The Venerable Anuruddha replied, "Blessed One, I am constantly at ease, lacking nothing." The Blessed One asked, "Anuruddha, in what way are you constantly at ease, lacking nothing?" And the Venerable Anuruddha replied, "Blessed One, I have this thought. It is a great gain for me. It is a great blessing for me that I am practicing together with such companions in the holy life." So he has this real appreciation, rejoicing in having living together with these other two monks. Blessed One, towards these companions in the holy life, I constantly practice bodily deeds of loving kindness, both seen and unseen, equally and without distinction. I practice verbal deeds of loving kindness and mental deeds of loving kindness, both seen and unseen, equally and without distinction. So, from the rejoicing, now we get the metta, the loving kindness or benevolence. And this is done by action, by words, and by thought. And it is also done without concern whether the others notice it or not. It's whether the others seen or whether it is unseen. It's done for its own sake, whether the others actually notice it or not. Blessed One, I have this thought. Let me now forego my own state of mind and follow the state of mind of those venerable friends. Then, Blessed One, I forego my own state of mind and follow the state of mind of those venerable friends. And this is very powerful to me. It is really this, what I find difficult, to let go of my own ideas of how I think things should be done and go along with the way others do it. This is something as a strong-minded personality and as a German, when I went to live in Sri Lanka, I really had to learn that. This is something very strong in Sri Lankan, and I assume in general in Southeast Asian culture, that things are done very much from this kind of group perspective and very less from what we in the West are used to, this kind of individual things and my rights and what I think is correct and this should be done. But this is an important factor, again, in leading to samatha. All of what we are discussing now is pointing in the direction of samatha. It is combining this with insight, but it's basically on samatha. Keeping the place in order, having an attitude of rejoicing in those with whom we are associated. And you might remember last year we had this beautiful discourse by Venerable Sariputta on how one can, in somebody who is bad in one respect, we can look at the good parts to rejoice in that. There's always a possibility of finding something positive. And if somebody is just totally bad through and through, then wow, sure, this is an excellent opportunity to have compassion. So there's always a way. People around us, circumstances are never perfect, but we can have a perfect attitude to that by looking at the good and not at the bad. By making space and opening up to the positive that is there among people, instead of going, here, I can see it there, look what he or she is doing, this is wrong, and I've heard it, and blah, blah, blah. All this is not meant to let go of our ability to see that something is incorrect, to be blind. It is open, clear seeing, but without that emotional reaction of being judgmental. And the other two monks express the same. And then the Buddha is very approving of this. The Blessed One praised them. Well done, Anuruddhas. He calls all three by the name of one of them. In these ways, you are constantly together in harmony, at ease and without contention, of a single mind, of a single teacher, blending like water and milk. This idea of water and milk blending is very beautiful. It really shows that there is no separation. Water and milk, if you put them together, they really blend with each other. And he continues, no doubt you also attain a superhuman state, a distinction, a peaceful abiding in tranquility. The Venerable Anuruddha replied, Blessed One, in these ways we are indeed constantly together in harmony, at ease and without contention, of a single mind, of a single teacher, blending like water and milk. We also attain a superhuman state, a state of distinction, a peaceful abiding in tranquility. Blessed One, we attain inner light and consequently vision of forms. But that vision of forms and inner light soon disappear again. The Blessed One said, Anuruddhas, you have not penetrated that sign, namely the sign of attaining inner light and vision of forms. Consequently, the vision of forms and the inner light soon disappear again. Yeah, this is a rather significant passage. And the term for sign is nimitta. And there was already a comment on this by Linda Grace in the forum. In the Pali version, the nimitta is translated as cause in the English translation. And so she says, telling his disciples you should discover the cause for that. It seems that by focusing on conditionality in this way, he is clearly outlining a practice of insight within the framework of developing jhana. I wanted to go on this a little bit in more detail. Because the term nimitta is very significant for meditative practice and for our overall topic of tranquility and insight. What I'm presenting to you now is based on an article I wrote for the Encyclopedia of Buddhism on nimitta, and I will be uploading this in OLAT. So if any of you wishes to follow this up and also look at the reference, it will be there in a little while. So nimitta is a sign, I think this is the translation I prefer, in the sense of being a characteristic mark of things. So we get, for example, in the Potaliya Sutta, there is somebody who looks like a householder. And when the Buddha then says, welcome householder, and this person, Potaliya, is upset, says, how can you call me a householder? The Buddha simply says, look, you have the nimittas of a householder. This is why I call you a householder. That is, he wears white and whatever. And another example, and I'm not putting in the references for you now, as you can download it in the article if you want to look up the discourses, is the Ratapala Sutta. There's a story of Ratapala who has gone forth when he was very young, and now he is visiting his home again after apparently many years have passed. And he is now with shaven head and robes. But the female servant of the family, she recognizes him by the nimitta. And I think she looks at his hands, if I remember correctly. So the nimitta is that which makes us recognize somebody or something. But the word nimitta also has a plain causal sense. And this is what the translation of the Upakilesa Sutta by Jnanamoli has, and what Linda Grace was pointing out, has a causal, as cause, it stands on a par with terms like nidana, hetu, and paccaya. All of these are causes or conditions. And this causal nuance of the term nimitta is also there in those earlier examples that I just took from Potaliya Sutta and the Ratapala Sutta, because there are certain aspects or features in what we perceive that cause us to recognize. That cause us to recognize, oh, this is an alayo, oh, this is a computer, oh, this is such and such a thing. There are certain, like when people make a drawing of a car and they just put a few lines on a paper, it has really nothing to do with a car. But because this drawing is such that we can recognize the shape of a car and the wheels, we recognize, oh, this is a car. So this little drawing, tuk, 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 is actually giving us the nimitta to get that mental perception, sanya, car. So in the case of the Ratapala Sutta, there were some aspects of this person, Ratapala, which the female servant at the house was familiar, so that when from afar she saw a monk, she didn't recognize him. But when she came closer, she realized, oh, but this is Ratapala. This is the son of my landlord. the fact that by way of the nimitta we recognize things also carries implication for the development of insight, because it is the nimitta that can lead to reactions also. There is, for example, the subha nimitta, the sign of beauty, where what is perceived is being latched on as beautiful and attractive, and that leads to the rising of desire and lust. Or there is the patiga nimitta, something is perceived as irritating, and that leads to the rising of aversion. And because of this propensity of the nimitta to lead to these reactions, the Mahavedala Sutta says that the three root defilements, lust, anger, and delusion, are makers of signs, nimitta karana. And in the practice of sense restraint, as one of the practices of the gradual path of training, the practitioner is told that you should not dwell on the signs, the nimitta, and on the what I think are the secondary associations, anuvyanjana, of sense objects. You should not latch on to them in order to avoid that the mind starts rolling in unwholesome thoughts. And the full awakening and the experience of nibbana is animitta. It is signless. There is no sign in nibbana. There's also a deep level of concentration called animitta samadhi, which in itself is not necessarily a sign of having reached the final goal. There's a story also of animitta samadhi, a monk having that and afterwards regressing. But it is based on a high degree of concentration, and it is this ability to be aware and concentrated without any kind of nimittas leading to corresponding perceptions. And now coming to what is the main topic of this discourse, as far as I can see, tranquility. We also get the nimitta in the relation to the development of concentration or tranquility. And we have expressions in the suttas such as samatha nimitta, the sign of tranquility, samadhi nimitta, the sign of concentration, and also citta nimitta, the sign of the mind. And the idea of nimitta as something that enables the cultivation of tranquility and concentration is something very prominent in the commentarial tradition. In the Visuddhimagga, we get a description of a concentration that progresses from a first seeing of an object, say for example a kasina object, a color or one of the elements, and this is called the parikamma nimitta. And then one trains that what one has seen in a normal way of perception, one closes the eyes and tries to see it on a purely mental level. And if one is able to mentally remember or see this, then this is called the uggaha nimitta, the nimitta that one has taken up. And when one uses this mental image and the mind becomes concentrated on it, the inner perception becomes very clear and very stable and very strong. And this is called the patibhaga nimitta. And it is with this patibhaga nimitta that, according to the commentary explanation, then the entry into the full absorption becomes possible. And in all these contexts, the causal nuance of nimitta continues, as all these are what causes one to get into deeper concentration. And so what I think we will not be able to fully explore this today, but what the question that is at the background for us now is, does this passage on inner light and vision of forms, does this refer to this type of nimitta described in the commentaries? And while there is no exact match, Len's cousins, another outstanding scholar from the UK, has argued that the Upakilesa Sutta, he based himself on the Pali version, is one of the most clear instances where we can see the beginning of the concept of the nimitta as it's found in the commentaries. And I find his argument convincing. But this is not shared by everyone. So now the Buddha explains that the difficulties that Anuruddha and his companions had were something he had himself when he was training, when he was trying to become awakened. Formerly, Anuruddhas, when I had not yet attained awakening to the supremely right and true path, I too attained inner light and vision of forms. But that vision of forms and inner light soon disappeared again. Anuruddhas, I had this thought. Practicing diligently without negligence, with the body tranquil and settled, with right mindfulness and right attentiveness, without confusion, I have attained concentration and mental unification. What in this world does not exist? Could I see it or know that? This doubt, this affliction arose in my mind. Because of this affliction of doubt, my concentration fell away and the inner eye ceased. And with the ceasing of the inner eye, the experience of bright light and the vision of forms are early attained, that vision of forms and inner light soon disappeared again. So if we read this based on Len's cousin's suggestion, then this makes a lot of sense. And in particular, I would like us to note that the dynamics behind the arising of doubt is mentioned only in the Chinese version. What in this world does not exist? Could I see it or know that? This information is not in the Pali. We are just told that doubt arose. And it is precisely when we move in our practice from the normal world perceived outside of us to that inner world of visions and appearances, in particular the experience of inner light, that such doubt naturally arouses. That the meditator wonders, like, what is this? Because it's in quality so different from the inner experience one is used from, say, dreaming when one is asleep, that there is this question. I mean, does it exist? Does it not exist? What is it? What I'm experiencing here? And my personal take on this is that it is based on another passage in Anguttara Nikaya, where it is said that pabassarang idang chitang yancha agantukusule upakilese upakilitang, the mind is luminous but is defiled by adventitious defilements. And if we look for this term pabassara elsewhere in the discourses, we find that it does not refer to a sort of naturally free from any defilement state of mind, but to the temporary freedom from defilement that comes with concentration practices. And based on that, I will suggest the interpretation that the mind that is temporarily free from defilement when approaching deeper concentration is experienced by many meditators as an inner form of luminosity, an inner light. And this is something we also know from other traditions of mysticism. And I would even venture to say that this might be symbolized in the fact that, for example, we see Christian mystics with this kind of aura of gold around their head. And I think it is possible that this inner experience of light and some vision of forms that the Upakilesa Sutta is talking about here, and that because of doubt or because of other upakilesas, smaller defilements, can disappear. And we will look at these smaller defilements next time. But I'd just like us to note quickly, this is where we're going to start off next time, that the gross defilements of sensual desire and aversion are not mentioned. They're just smaller or finer defilements. They're called upakilesas. And this is precisely the point where, according to the commentarial explanation, also the nimitta, the patibhaga nimitta arises, when the gross defilements have been overcome and when it's really a question of fine-tuning the mind so that it can get into absorption. So here we are. I hope I have been able to say at least a few things of interest, and it has not been too tiring to go through all these topics. And yeah, we will take up next time starting from this list of upakilesas. We are taking a little while to go through this discourse, but it's all very much on the main topic we do. So thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to the discussion in the forum, your contributions, and to seeing you again next week.